Hello, and welcome to episode 27 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Nick Zoutra. Today on the podcast, I am very pleased to welcome Dr. Sherife Tekin, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Damon College in Buffalo, New York. Sherife's philosophical interests are in philosophy of science, philosophy of mind and cognitive science, and ethics. Currently, Sherife is working on her manuscript, Reclaiming the Self in Psychopathology, Science, Narratives, and Persons, in which she makes a case for including the self as an explicit target of research in scientific psychiatry in order to develop humanistic care practices in the clinic and beyond, especially those that help those with mental disorders flourish. Empirical research on psychopathology and first-person narratives of mental disorders are central to this work. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Sherife. Dr. Sherife Tekin, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this morning?
Thank you. I'm very good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. It is nice and sunny here in Bloomington, which is, I don't want to say unusual, but it is a pleasant surprise that it
is. Yes, that's nice. Buffalo is cold and cloudy. I guess that's perhaps not surprising.
No, oh no. I was just going to... Yeah, I was just going to ask. I've never been to Buffalo. You know, what is it like this time of year?
I actually love Buffalo. It's such a like nice up-and-coming, exciting to be... city to be in. Right now it's the end of summer. There are lots of festivals and you know, like fresh produce, farmers markets, and so on. So it's actually, fall is one of my favorite seasons in the fall in Buffalo. It's like long and leaves are changing color. It's very pretty.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
And at which university are you currently teaching?
I'm at a liberal arts college called Damon College. It's Amherst, New York, which is basically a suburb of Buffalo.
Okay.
Yes.
Fantastic. And have you guys started the term there yet?
We did. We actually started this week, and I had my first classes this week. So, and Friday is my day off from teaching. So,
good.
Good first week. Yes.
Good. Yeah. So, are you teaching anything of interest this term?
I regularly teach medical ethics at Damon College. That's like primarily like what I was hired for, and I really, really enjoy teaching medical ethics. Medicine is such a alive field, and there's always something new and interesting. And most of my students are in the healthcare professions, such as physician assistants, physical therapy, nursing, and so on. They have to take this class, so I use this kind of as an opportunity to instill kind of good moral ideas in them, and that is responsive to science. So it's always very exciting. And I'm also teaching a philosophy of science course, which is, you know, of course, I absolutely love teaching. So, yeah.
Great. So, no, I was just going to ask where, who is the audience for the medical ethics course? And I'm happy to hear that it's, you know, those who going into the medical profession, I'm sure, as well as some interested humanities and science students.
Exactly. Yes.
And the phil sci course, is that for a major in philosophy there, or is that a more of a?
That's also like a third year elective. It's a writing intensive course, which is actually good. I can kind of get students like write. So we have some philosophy and religious studies students in it, but we also have a lot of natural science students and like PT, physical therapy students. So, and actually this year I have a few art students who are really excited. So I'm very excited about that conversation between art students and science students and medicine students. So that will be very interesting to watch.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, I'm very excited for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, why don't we get started back at the beginning, then we'll catch back up with what you're doing this term and what's going on with you. But Sherife, where did you grow up?
So I grew up in a city called Denizli. It's on the west coast of Turkey, or near the west coast, I should say. So I grew up in Turkey, and I did my undergraduate degree in Ankara at the Middle East Technical University, and then I left Turkey to move to Canada for graduate school, etc. So
okay, so
Well, so I believe you're the first Turkish philosopher of science we've had on the podcast. So very happy to have you. Deniz Leya, and this is in, I'm just looking it up here. I'm afraid to look like it is in the southwest region of Turkey.
Exactly.
Okay. What's it like in Deniz Leya?
So at the time, I mean, it's like in Turkey, depending on the region you're in, like there are kind of different vibes. And in the west coast, southwest coast in general, there's this kind of sea vibe. The weather is the it's a typical Mediterranean climate. Winters are short. People are out and about for most of the year. And at the time, Denizli was kind of growing very, you know, culturally as well. There are lots of kind of open-minded liberal folks who live in that area. So when I was growing up, I remember like there would be jazz concerts or like different kind of, you know, like all the things that, you know, nerds like me like, different bookstores. So it was a nice, very manageable city. You could walk everywhere. That was also kind of rich in like various educational opportunities. There were really good schools, and there still are very good, you know, schools with people who are really interested in learning. Yeah.
So I actually just came across something on your website as you're describing that, you know, having grown up in Denizli, Turkey. You spent your childhood and adolescence on the Aegean coast, hanging around the ruins of ancient Greek civilization. I'd like to think that I'm a philosopher because I walked on the soils that the Greek gods, goddesses, and philosophers left their footprints.
Yes.
Inhaled the salty, swimming the air. This is a fantastic quote, by the way. Yeah, so what was that like, growing up in this particular area? And, I mean, was it only later having, you know, been introduced to philosophy or that you have then reflected and appreciated where you grew up? Or was there something going on in childhood?
I mean, you can kind of write your life narrative, you know, in the way that you want to kind of connect the dots in a way. But I mean, when I think about it, so we had a summer home in Didim. This is near where the Malaysian philosophers had lived, you know, like Thales, Menes and Eximondros. That's the region in Turkey where they grew up. And we had a summer home right, I think it's about 10 miles from the Malaysian circle, like with where the like ruins and temples and stuff are. So I was exposed to that kind of ancient Greek civilization at a very young age. I would spend my summers in our summer home, like swimming. And I was always very interested in history and ancient Greek civilization and philosophy. So I think I was very lucky to be exposed to that. But when I was a child, I didn't think, you know, my full-time job where I make money would be, you know, to be a philosopher. But philosophy was always like one of the most important things to me as an individual. And I really didn't think at the time that I would end up being a philosopher. But yeah, here I am.
Sure, but these kinds of questions, they were important to you.
They were important to me, yes, yes.
Okay. What were your parents up to at the time?
Yeah, so that's also an important part, I think. My dad was an educator, so he was a teacher, and then his job was like something that's similar to what school superintendents in the U.S. do. So he would kind of go to different schools, inspect their education, their curriculum, and so on. So he was a teacher, and my mom was a housewife. She didn't, like, I mean, it's kind of hard to say she didn't work because she always worked so hard.
Yeah.
She just did a, you know, full-time occupation. And they were both very education and reading-oriented people. We had, my dad was a socialist, so we had like Marx, Freud books in the library, and he himself was very interested in sociology and psychology and so on. So, I mean, being a, you know, school superintendent, he was very interested in adolescent psychology and so on. So I think those were very important influences in the family as a whole. And everybody, I have two sisters, everybody took reading and studying very seriously. So
great. Were these older or younger sisters?
There are two older sisters.
Okay.
The oldest one is 7 years older than me, and she's actually a professor of infectious diseases in Turkey, so she's a medical doctor. And my other sister, the middle sister, she's a lawyer. And
family.
Yeah, it's a very professional family. Yeah. So that's how it works. Yeah.
Great. And do the majority of your family, do they still... Do they still live in Turkey?
Yeah, they do. They are still in Turkey.
Okay. Okay. All right. So, what are some of your other interests growing up? You know, in terms of philosophy, you know, history, philosophy. I mean, were these your primary interests, or did you do other activities or things?
If you ask, like, you know, my you know, elementary or high school teachers, like, what was Shirfe like, they would probably say, like, oh, she was so good at math because I loved math and calculus and geometry. And I was kind of really ambitious about, like, math. I was very, very excited about that. But I also was on the one hand, I had this kind of more analytic, you know, frame of mind where I really enjoyed, like, logic and math and so on. But I was also very into, like, theater and drama and the arts. In fact, I had a very brief career of acting when I was in high school. That was very brief, but, yeah. I wanted to kind of find another opportunity to do that again, which never happened. But I was kind of a curious, you know, person. And I wrote a lot. I read and wrote a lot. I used to write short fiction and short stories and so on, especially my adolescent years.
What kind of stories?
They were kind of like magic realist stories. Like, okay. I think I was very influenced by mythology. So I would, like, these would be kind of, you know, 20th century, like, modern, mythologically inspired kind of short stories. And I had one story that won some kind of national award, which was actually, I wrote it after my father passed away, and it was very influenced by kind of, you know, that whole, the whole experience. So
I guess this during your adolescent years?
Yeah, 14, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was very challenging, but I think that experience, of course, kind of, you know, grown me a lot as an adult. And,
Of course. Well, that's fantastic to hear. So, you know, continuing on with writing. Okay, so, you know, it sounds like you had a lot of varied interests. In terms of following childhood, did you go to undergraduate in Turkey?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. So there were like two like very well recognized international universities that I could have gone. One in Ankara. It's a like international university. It's a Middle East technical university. It's a very technical school. They have a lot of science and math departments, but they're also very good in social sciences, including philosophy. And the other option would be to go to Istanbul, to Boğaziçi University. And at the time in Turkey, kind of all of these are changing so fast, but at the time you had to write a university entrance exam, and according to your score, you would pick a department or a major. And at the time, like, being very good at math and also being interested in kind of these social issues and so on, I decided to be an economist. I thought that studying economics would kind of give me both the, like, joy of doing math and, you know, modeling and, you know, kind of having this certain, like, science foot, but also if I applied it to social issues and so on, that would be interesting. So that's what I did. I did, kind of passed the exam, and I started in the Middle East Technical University in Ankara. So I moved there and started studying economics.
So was this, at the time that you took the exam, was this a year or so prior to then enrolling in university? Did you have to prepare?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Mm. So that was like, and that was this whole life, a whole thing of its own, like preparing for this exam, because the exam wasn't necessarily the questions that you would be asked in the exam wasn't necessarily reflective of the curriculum that you learned in the school. So it kind of required this, like, different kind of preparation, for which at the time in Turkey, there were all these, like, private tutoring schools that you would go to just to kind of get ready for this exam.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's very problematic in so many ways, because your entire life is contingent upon how you perform in those 3 hours. And, you know, you might get sick or nervous and that you lose, like, a year, basically, to wait for the next round. Thankfully, nothing like that happened to me, and I did well in the exam. And as you said, like, you write the exam in the spring, the results are announced in July, and you enroll for the department for the university in the fall.
Yeah. Was economics? It sounds like it combined all of your interests or combine a number of your interests into to one particular path. Was this something that your parents or your mother at the time was encouraging? I guess I'm curious about like what was expected of Turkish children and students in terms of, you know, like depends where you're from. That's kind of like what is the standard mode of professionalization or at the time?
Yeah. Exactly. No, that's a really good question. Actually, there's a great kind of little illustration comic book just came out called Dare to Disappoint, Growing Up in Turkey, which like I really like love the author because I felt like she's some. I mean, we are around the same generation. It sounds like she summarized like the main motives of parents when they're kind of helping their children. And so I'm coming from it like educating family, and you know, it was kind of financially challenging a bit after we lost my dad, as you could expect. So it was like I was motivated to actually find a job that will make money. Like that was kind of important. Like so, and in that sense, economics was ideal because I could kind of, and this is one of the best universities in Turkey. Mm-hmm. I could graduate and get a job, like, you know, right away in an accounting firm or in a bank, or, you know, I can work for the government, or so there were like all of these different opportunities. So I thought that was a kind of smart choice, that I would be enjoying what I was studying, but also, you know, I would be making money. And that incentive to, you know, have a job or have a training that you could do something with, you know, very practical in the end, was like a lot of, you know, my generation people were kind of indoctrinated. Like, you have to have interests that will kind of earn you a living in the end, which I suppose is not quite different, you know, in other parts of the world. And as a philosopher, I think you can kind of relate to, what are you going to do with that question?
Of course. But, it's still something that you might get from time to time. And I think it's also not unreasonable to consider the practical, like the application of the skill or the education that is what you're learning. You know, beginning an an economics path. So what happened? What happened in university? What was going on then?
Yeah. So Middle East Technical University was such a like wonderful place to be at the time. I mean, it had like, you know, economics department was fantastic. I had great professors and education was great, but also socially, it was a great place. There were lots of like clubs, you know, and movie clubs and climbing clubs and photography clubs. So as a student, you not only kind of studied and, you know, wrote your exams, but also participated in that active social and intellectual life on campus. Like I watched so many great, interesting European films on campus, like, it was like really fascinating, and it really, really enriched kind of the way I think about everything. So it was a wonderful place to be in that regard.
That's fantastic. For our, you know, folks at home, you know, you graduated only in 2002. So, you know, you're relatively up and coming in terms of your professional career. And so this is in the early 2000s, what kinds of films were coming out and where were they coming from?
So there was a lot of like European like directors. I'm thinking, you know, I watched the kind of I think it was Kieslowski, the Red Blue like series, like the film, like the same director. I watched a lot of Tarkovsky movies. So it was kind of, they were kind of, or, you know, 2001 Space Odyssey, like there were all these kind of mixed, more alternative films that you wouldn't necessarily catch, you know, in Hollywood or like whatever. So that was, that was very like important. And also there would be film festivals, where like, you know, there would be like one session would be like 10 short films from France at like 9 a.m. in the morning. Friday morning, you would get up and like go watch those like 10 short films, like, you know, French films. And obviously, I don't remember all of them, but it was just like kind of, you know, being exposed to that entire world of like movies and different cultures was like really interesting and kind of enriching.
Yeah, it's great to hear you say this. I had a somewhat of a similar experience being exposed to quite a bit of independent film and just, I suppose, award-winning film at university. I'm just curious of, sounds like it's an enriching, how do you feel it maybe interacted at all with your studies or how you were kind of growing up at the time?
Exactly. So I had decided, like, right when I got into the economics department at the university, that I would also do a minor in philosophy.
Okay.
And that was going to be, like, just what I was going to do. I didn't really think that I would end up being a philosopher, but I was like, I want to learn more philosophy. And, you know, at school, you're encouraged to do more than, like, one minor, or, like, you know, add, like, different majors to your own, like, major and so on. So I was really excited about that. And that was very good because, you know, I did a history of philosophy minor. So I would go to my philosophy class, and with some of my classmates, we would go see a film. And, you know, it would be just like, you know, then we would talk about the film and philosophy. So it was very kind of interesting and enriching because you got to I think that a lot of, like, good thinking happens in conversation, like, where you're really challenged or kind of forced to think differently when you're trying to talk to someone else. Mm-hmm. So that was very interesting and helpful, and I really, really enjoyed my undergraduate experience for that.
That's fantastic. So at what point, it sounds like, that did the major in economics – I shouldn't say that yet. So, you know, studying economics – How were things going further along with that? I mean, was the plan still to apply this degree? What were you thinking?
So, I mean, I was, like, early on, I kind of started getting more disillusioned about me being an economist. I mean, I really, again, enjoyed the kind of technical math part, and we were taking these advanced calculus courses, econometrics, like, you know, you learn modeling, you know, and kind of making predictions about the, like, future unemployment rate and inflation. So that was all very exciting. But I was also very interested in the history of economics classes. I was doing a minor in philosophy. And at the time, this was a fantastic system. And I think some schools in the U.S. also has it. You could, like, if your grades were good, you could apply to be a student assistant for a class. So in my third year as an economics student, the history of economics professor who was teaching first year history of economics class was looking for a teaching assistant to help him teach the class. And you could apply, and you would, like, instead of getting a pay for your work, you would be graded out of your performance as a teaching assistant. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So,
I've never really heard of that, to be honest. No. But that's kind of, it's not to be evaluated based on how well you assisted.
Exactly. So that was a course. It was kind of like this professional development course. And, you know, you would be graded for with that. And I was very, like, I was a third year economics student, and I was teaching first years, some of whom were my age or older than me. So it was kind of like, really interesting experience. And the first class I thought, like, was terrible. I remember it so well because I was so nervous. But that experience was great because I got to learn the history of economics and history of civilization really well. And that combined really well with my history of philosophy training in the like in my minor. So then I remember my professor in the economics department who I was TAing for said, Shirife, I think you should go to grad school in philosophy.
Huh?
It was one afternoon in my third year. I was graduating next year. I was like, what? Like, I never thought of that. Yeah. He's like, I think you're a lot more excited about philosophy than, like, you know, economics. And that was a very acute, good observation, I think. And that kind of suddenly gave me more kind of direction and excitement about what I want to do when I graduate, even though, like, I was kind of avoiding thinking about what I would do when I graduate. So, well,
yeah. So what do you think? I mean, it's funny that it's not too surprising that, you know, an outside party observes something and is telling something in, you know, I think you have a greater interest, you know, and it's something that, you know, was helped you to come to on your own. I mean, how do you think that came about? What was it that allowed this professor to see through, to see that your interest?
Yeah, so I was TAing, like, basically I was teaching the recitation hours after his lectures. But he said one day, well, why don't you teach? So I'm going to be teaching Enlightenment next week in the, you know, history of economics class and how it, you know, what happened in the economic side of things during the Enlightenment. Why don't you give a lecture on Enlightenment and philosophy, like, to the class? So that was would be, and then he's like, I can observe you, whatever. So it was very nerve-wracking, but I really enjoyed writing that lecture on enlightenment, and I really tried hard to kind of make the connections between enlightenment open philosophy and enlightenment period in economics. So mm-hmm. I prepared a lot for that lecture, and I had so much fun like teaching it. It was great. It was after that he said, I think you should go to grad school in philosophy. So that was like, and nobody else had kind of suggested anything like that to me. I mean, my family is educated, but still, like, nobody else had gone to graduate school, or I didn't know what professors do. So that world was really new to me, and kind of, you know, interacting with my professors in the economics department and so on. I'm like, oh, this is a career path. So one could actually, you know, make money and, you know, make a living out of teaching or researching. So that was very kind of illuminating and exciting.
That's very exciting. Well, I'm well so happy that you found your way or a way into this. I am generally interested. You're also the first economist that we've had on the podcast, or I should say. I mean, what was it, or perhaps can you recall any particularly interesting historical events in economics, or having studied the history of economics, that you found fascinating that you would care to share?
Yes. So feudalism is always very interesting to me in the, you know, Middle Ages, how church basically owns all the land, and there are these feudal lords who pay taxes to the church, and their serfs are, you know, like villagers who are working kind of for the lord. And like individuals don't own anything, nobody has property. And this is all kind of, it's very interesting because it's an economic system, but it's all dressed under kind of this religious system, like church and so on. So it was very complex, and then kind of then transition to, you know, Renaissance and Reformation and the kind of invention of printing and people starting to think and read for themselves the Bible, and then kind of this, that, you know, this kind of abolishment of that feudal like system, and how that both simultaneously happened with the kind of intellectual like Renaissance and Reformation period, and how like economics, philosophy, society, like all are related, all are part of the same package. So that was like, that always fascinated me. I still get very excited talking about that, even in my, you know, philosophy of science class, where, you know, we're talking about Copernicus, Galileo, like heliocentric system, you know, the centric system and so on. So I think that was like that's been always interesting for me to think about. That's at least that's the first thing that comes
absolutely
to my mind.
No, thank you. I mean, I know I'm like, yeah, what did you remember 20, you know, so long ago, but it's that's fascinating. Thank
I'm worried that my economics professors are going to be listening to this podcast.
Oh, I hope you do share it with them. And okay. All right. So, you know, having learned that this was a professional choice, an option in philosophy, what came about next? What were your plans?
So that was also kind of complex. I mean, again, so in my undergraduate, like I was like tutoring. I mean, I like was kind of earning my own like way into school, and I was getting scholarships and fellowships. So I didn't have a lot of resources to like apply to a lot of graduate schools and whatnot. So one thing that was clear early on to me, was made clear by my professors, that, okay, if you want to kind of get a good job at a good university in Turkey, like, you know, Middle East Technical University or Boğaziçi University, you have to do your graduate degrees abroad, because education language at these schools is English. And, you know, they tend to hire PhDs with, you know, foreign degrees. That's kind of part of the whole training process. So it was very clear early on that I had to kind of go abroad for my degrees, and I really wanted that. I mean, it wasn't like that easy being a young woman in Turkey. I think things are getting kind of worse now, but I really wanted to kind of be in a society where, you know, people were, you know, there was more gender equality and so on. So think I'd have to kind of go abroad for these like professional reasons was such a welcome idea for me, because that meant that, you know, I could also be in a place where, you know, I live more freely, or I am kind of considered more of an equal, and I could kind of, you know, make something out of myself, which I didn't really think that, you know, staying in Turkey would necessarily allow me to be the person that I wanted to be. So that's kind of how I started thinking about graduate school in the U.S. or Canada.
Yeah. So, I mean, so, you know, being a part of the university life, I guess I don't, I don't know what it's like in terms of, you know, the hardships that one can face. I mean, if you wouldn't mind sharing, what was it like?
Well, I mean, there is like the kind of the world of like Middle East Technical University, like that campus, like beautiful and modern and progressive and amazing. And then there's the outside world. So one thing that was kind of very disturbing to me and kind of observing as an adolescent too. So when my father passed, so I was part of like very progressive, enlightened, like family. They were not traditional people at all. But then when my father died, I suddenly kind of confronted with this like real face of Turkey. And, you know, like I was, so basically like there were three daughters and the mother who lost their father, like, you know, widow and her three daughters. And that was, came with a bunch of like stigma in its own right, like just kind of the virtue of like not having a man in the family. So that was kind of like, you know, you would like be extra scrutinized, like, or extra judged and so on. And I don't think that, like, would have happened if, you know, I had a male brother or, like, whatever. And even kind of having three sisters, like, or three, like, and we were all, like, wanting to be educated. And my mom was very liberal and progressive. She always trusted us for whatever we did and always supported. But it wasn't so, like, kind of easy. I mean, I remember, like, in my high school even, which was still a better school than others, but there were these like the kind of my the school principal pulled me into his room a week after my father died and threatened me to not bring forbidden books to school, and that now that my father is dead, you know, he is my father, he's everything. Like, it was very paternalistic, and like I was like, what? I'm 14, like. Like, wow. What forbidden? So it was very, very, like, I came home crying. I never saw my mom that upset. It was a Friday afternoon, and she just, like, barely got through, like, Monday. And then she went to school on Monday and kind of put the principal in his place. And you have no right to kind of abuse my daughter this way. You know, I am his mom, her mom, and, you know, like, you don't get to suddenly, like, be her father or whatever. So it was like, pressures like that, like, you know, came out of nowhere. And I was a really good student. Like, I was an A-plus student, and I was always kind of getting these honors and, you know, like, recognitions nationally. Still, like, I was kind of, you know, being bullied. So in that sense, like, I kind of, like, had this, like, very, like, deep anger like to that kind of environment, and I wanted to, like, I really felt like that was limiting my potential and my possibilities. I'm like, I want to be in a place where I'm judged for what I do and not like based on my gender or whether or not I have a like a live father. So sorry,
I really appreciate you sharing that. I just hadn't thought of I mean, family dynamics are very tricky, and especially, you know, in different cultures and different places. And to think, I mean, yeah, certainly that's obviously very inappropriate by the principal. But just, yeah, I mean, I could see that having a pretty big impact on decisions to stay in Turkey.
Yes, exactly.
And just, yeah. So, okay, so, you know, having finished undergrad, what did you decide to do?
So basically, yeah, I mean, if I wanted to start graduate school, like my master's, like right away, right after, like undergraduate, I had to apply, I mean, as you know, like a year in advance, right, to be placed. And at that time, I had to write a TOEFL exam to, you know, prove my English proficiency. That was a requirement for international applicants for different universities. You had to write a, you know, other kind of the LSAT exam, I think was like the other one that I had to write. So I was kind of getting ready to write those exams, and they were so expensive. Like, it's kind of, and this is prior to emailing or email or online applications, and I had to like literally send my portfolio like by UPS, like internationally. Mm-hmm. So I have to be really smart about where I apply and where I can get in with scholarship. I mean, that was the other condition. There was no way that I could afford, you know, paying international student fees and so on. And at the time, so I wrote to a few schools in the United States and in Canada, and I don't remember which ones actually, which is weird. But again, this is like before internet was like a big and very important thing. Like I kind of was kind of learning my way around as I was doing things. I sent an email to some PhD programs in the US, and their, you know, FIOSF programs are mostly PhDs. They basically said, listen, like you look, it's very exciting to get your, you know, email, but your undergraduate degree is not in philosophy, so we won't be able to kind of accommodate your desire to start a PhD program right away, right? They were concerned that I didn't have enough philosophical background, which I think is a kind of fair concern. But in Canada, it was different. They did have more MA programs, and they were more open to kind of giving funding to master's students and so on. So I applied to a few schools in Canada, and also September 11 happened that time. Which is like, yeah, it was that. Actually, I remember I took a TOEFL test, came home, and learned the news about the attacks. So
I'm sure that's great for international applicants. Then
I was like, there goes US. Like it was just kind of like, and I was very. I mean, I've been always a very pragmatic person. I was like, okay, so I better apply for kind of places that have a likely, you know, high chance of like accepting me. And that was great. So I got an acceptance from like a few universities in Canada, and then University of Saskatchewan also gave me a very generous funding. And it was a two-year MA program, which was also attractive because, again, I didn't have an undergraduate degree in philosophy. I wanted to make sure that I would have enough kind of background to catch up with. I would have enough time to catch up with the background deficits and like write a thesis at the same time.
Sure.
So that's how I went from Turkey to Saskatoon, which was like very different.
Yeah. How was that transition?
Oh, Saskatoon is such a great place. It's a very small town. And it like, I mean, I was coming from like a very chaotic, like big city in Ankara and like, you know, Istanbul. It's like, you know, these are big cities and so on. Whereas like Saskatoon is just like small, very calm place. People are kind. And I had a fantastic department. They were very, very supportive of like international students. And like there were two more international students in the department. And I made great friends there, and I spent 2 years. It was very good because that was the first place I was coming as an international student. And of course, like you're worried, you're insecure. I'm like, will they understand my English? And you know, what if they can't? And like, it was just, there were all these like worries, sure, rational sure. worries. And it was like, it was nice to be at a welcoming, warm. I mean, it's funny. Saskatoon is really cold. It snows in October, but you know, ironically, people. Yes.
Yeah, I'm seeing it here. I actually wasn't particularly, regionally, it's just north of, in between, so from the U.S. side, it's from north of Montana and North Dakota. Saskatchewan. It's a province, yeah. And yes, in the University of Saskatchewan.
So I was there for 2 years, and then from there, I applied for PhD programs. And I, like when I started, I mean, having done a little bit of history of philosophy in my undergraduate, and like I was a big fan of like Nietzsche. I mean, I was really interested in continental philosophy. Mm-hmm. So I was also very interested in like Wittgenstein and economics. Again, like I had like these like multiple interests, but I was always interested in working on the concept or the notion of self. Like that was always a very attractive topic for me. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that I was just trying to make sense of the world, and very like I was a very introspective child. I was, you know, I was always think a lot, so I was always very drawn to the topic. And when I got accepted at York University for my PhD, I was very excited because there were philosophers there, like David Jopling, who later supervised my dissertation, who was an expert on the self, and also there were people like Kristen Andrews, who did philosophy of science and mind from a kind of more empirical perspective. So I got accepted from a few schools, and then I chose to go to York because it had a lot of the things that I was interested in.
Fantastic. So, I mean, at the time, was there a transition in your master's period such that you were sounded like you were, you know, interested in continental philosophy, interested in notions of the self, but was philosophy of science on the radar at during your master's?
No, actually not. Like, I think like philosophy of mind was definitely on the radar, sure, philosophy of science. I always thought, I mean, philosophy of economics was kind of becoming a thing at the time. So I kind of do something with this economics knowledge, but again, I wasn't that motivated enough to kind of do research in that area. But I think like I took some like political philosophy and philosophy of mind classes at University of Saskatchewan that was like, oh, this is exciting. Kind of excited to just learn all of these about new areas in philosophy. And I thought, oh, like actually analytic philosophy or the style of doing analytic philosophy is a lot more fit for the kind of work that I do, in the sense that like I'm an economist, I love numbers, I love logic. So it's like really kind of appealing to like develop arguments and think about the kind of tightness of the arguments. So that was like, okay, so this is also a viable option. So I was very open-minded, I guess. I just wanted to learn more, and I kind of, let what was coming to my way shape my interests and what I end up doing. And I'm glad I did, because now it's kind of a nice combination of all of these different things that I've done.
All right. So moving on, Ed, to York University, how was your time there? What was that like?
Oh, that was just fantastic. I love living in Toronto. Toronto is still one of my favorite cities in the world. I had a great department, and like department at the time, York's philosophy department was like, they were doing all these new hires, and there was a lot of exciting, like kind of reshaping of the program happening. And I got a lot of support for the work I've done. It was both financial support and, you know, professors like Kristen Andrews, who would, you know, make sure that I go present at this conference and pay for a lot of her own grants and so on. And also they were really encouraging. I kind of gave talks in the department. They kind of helped me with my dissertation, obviously. So I found like the environment to be really, really supportive. And also I was lucky because I was living right near University of Toronto. And I had gotten, I took a philosophy of clinical psychology class actually in the fall of my first semester there.
Okay.
And that's like very interesting. And that was taught by David Jopling, who is my supervisor, who ended up being my supervisor. And that course was phenomenal because suddenly we were like reading Freud and psychoanalysis, but also more kind of empirically oriented cognitive psychology, Ulrich Neisser and so on. So that was a very great course. And we read Ian Hacking. That's actually how I kind of like became more explicitly interested in philosophy of science. And I was fascinated by Hacking's work. And, you know, my work is very influenced by his work. And I realized that he just retired from University of Toronto, and that his office is just two blocks from where I live.
Oh, wow.
So I was very courageous and kind of curious. I emailed him and wanted to talk to him about like his work. So, and that was great. And then he like hired me as his research assistant. So we did some research on autism together, and that kind of like really helped so much. Like suddenly now I was working with Hacking on autism and like different mental disorders. And I had like David Jopling, who's an expert in cognitive science and like the self, and like Kristen Andrews, who's work in animal cognition is highly informed by, empirical experiences in the field. So suddenly I had like these three people supervising me for my dissertation. So that was just, I can't imagine a better scenario of how like things kind of ended up for me. So that was really, really great. That was a great 6 years of graduate school.
Absolutely. So you mentioned you've written about on philosophy of self in its psychiatric context and other contexts. Was your questioning or interest in this question, do you think that connected or tied directly into your interest in the philosophy of clinical psychology?
Exactly. Because I mean, one way to kind of think about the self is when you think about like what goes on when something is not right, like, you know, kind of like that, you know, like there is a kind of moral psychology, or like, you know, where it is likeness of like the selfness, but also there's like what happens, you know, what happens when a person is like depressed, or how is that changing? How does that transform or change the self? And what kind of stories do we tell about ourselves? I mean, narratives, like, you know, narrative understandings of the self ended up being the main topic of my dissertation. And now I'm kind of moving a little bit away from that. But that was kind of interested in the stories that people with mental illness told themselves about their illness.
So, yeah, I'm curious about this. So perhaps if you wouldn't mind sharing with us a little bit of like what were the main questions you were addressing in your dissertation work related to this narrative understanding of self?
Yes. So one thing that was, I mean, so the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, as you know, we know that this is the kind of primary diagnosis. It provides a primary diagnostic criteria and used widely, you know, in North America and like different parts of the world. At the time, and like on all of our categories of understanding of mental illness is shaped by that framework. And that is a kind of it's a scientific business in that we are trying to carve out and individuate individual mental disorders and by looking at its symptoms and signs. So it's a scientific project about like kind of carving things up, maybe not at nature, you know,
carving nature at its joints, or if you have another metaphor that works.
Exactly, right? Like, or, you know, kind of dividing things up, like classifying, right? Like taxonomizing. Yeah. That's like, you know, that's a classification. And so how we kind of, and we do that, or psychiatry does that primarily for the purposes of, you know, coming up with a good diagnosis of the individual and actually understanding the etiology of, like, say, depression or schizophrenia, so that, again, with the goal of, you know, finding effective treatments or interventions that we can do to help these individuals. So that's a scientific project. But I was also interested in the kind of role psychiatric taxonomy played in shaping people's self-understanding. How, you know, so there's one thing that, you know, say a person is diagnosed with depression, you know, and they kind of receive some kind of treatment or psychotherapy or medical treatment or both, like to address them. So that's like the kind of, you know, more, you know, therapeutic, what I call the therapeutic impact of the diagnosis. But there's also kind of this more reflective impact. Like now suddenly the person is thinking themselves as a depressed individual. And this is kind of the core idea in like Hacking's notion of looping effects, how scientific classifications influence people's self-concepts and behavior. And how, because of that, people change their self-understanding and behavior, which then might lead scientists to come up with different or new classifications. But I was kind of more interested in that self-understanding bit. So what is it that about psychiatric diagnosis that is affecting the individuals the way they do? And in the like philosophical literature, there is narrative approaches to the self, to the concept of self. The idea is, I mean, both narrative and self are very convoluted, fuzzy concepts that, you know, there are lots of like kind of debates around them. But kind of briefly, the idea is that we experience ourselves as narratives, like as a kind of, you know, and this narrative is kind of can mean, you know, a being in time with a beginning and middle and the end, but also a kind of narrative as a cognitive sense making tool. Kind of we make sense of what happens to us in the form of narratives. I mean, what you're doing in your podcast is basically engaging with people's own stories of, you know, how they could.
Somewhat, you know, in a sense, kind of imparting a narrative that is, I'm kind of, that's the structure we're choosing here, but it's not, obviously, that's not how life necessarily unfolds. I mean, things unfold sequentially, but yeah.
Exactly. But I mean, but then we selectively represent all those individual bits and kind of, oh, and this is who I am and this is how I came about. So that seemed like a good venue, kind of good philosophical venue to explore how, you know, diagnosis of mental illness might be influencing people with mental disorder that is beyond that therapeutic effect and has this reflective effect. So I kind of provided a critique of the DSM from that perspective. So not only it's not the best scientific tool out there to kind of carve out, you know, how like what mental disorders are, but also it has that kind of powerful impact on the way individuals make sense of themselves and the way they respond to their illness. In that, like, if you suddenly think that, oh, like, schizophrenia is, like, can't changeable, like, I'll end up losing my job or whatever. I mean, none of these things are told by the DSM, but the kind of, sure. You can read a lot of incomplete, horrible information and news stories out there that misrepresents the facts and mm-hmm. yet can't help but be influenced by that kind of narrative. So kind of I made the argument that, DSM is not just a scientific tool, but it's also an ethical tool. It's also an ethical question about how we must talk about mental disorders so that people respond to it a lot more effectively. So that was kind of, those were the main things that I was trying to kind of get at my dissertation.
Fantastic. And how was the dissertation received?
One thing that I kind of like stumbled upon this methodology, which then ended up being like one of the main things that my work has been known for, is I was interested in like how people with mental illness, think about themselves. Right. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I can't read this like anywhere else. I mean, I can't interview the clinicians because I would be interviewing clinicians, not the patients themselves. And I'm not a sociologist or a social scientist like mm-hmm. to go around and there are kind of inventories or questionnaires on, to people with mental illness. I'm like, how about I read some memoirs of people who were diagnosed with mental illness and kind of look at how they understood themselves? And this was such a welcome methodology just because of the makeup of my committee. Yeah. I had like people who were very interested in what goes on in the real world. So they were very encouraging of this. And at the time, I actually remember this so well. In 2006, as I was working on my dissertation, I was trying to get a hold of people's memoirs of mental illness. And, there are the like, kind of classic, John Stuart Mill has an account of his depression. And there are kind of more modern examples. But there weren't that many kind of memoirs that I could just randomly pick up and kind of read. And I emailed like a number of professors of mine saying, here's the project I'm doing, and if you kind of can think of a like mental illness story or memoir, can you send it to my way? And I tell this because I think it's very interesting because in the last since 13 years, there's a tremendous increase in the number of people who are writing about their mental illnesses. So I was kind of right in that transition, and then like as I was writing the dissertation, there were more and more memoirs being published, and I was trying to incorporate them all to my writing, and so on. So and I think that was one of the things that was received very well. In different communities where I was appealing to the first person accounts of illness while recognizing their potential limitations, of course. So
as a philosopher and a philosopher of science, how did you, I'm curious about like, this is like a methodological question, how you inferred or made claims regarding the memoirs in terms of then the narrative self. So, did you take them at face value? Did you have some sort of, conciliatory, I don't know. What was your method or analysis in terms of understanding the memoirs?
I have like so many footnotes in my dissertation and so many like these like long exegesis where I like calm all the skeptics down.
Okay.
So I'm going to, use some of these memoirs to illustrate some of the arguments that I'm making because I'm making an empirical claim in the sense like that. The way we think about mental illness can kind of, expand or, constrain our flourishing. Like that was kind of the like main thing. So I'm like, and I kind of provided some, research in the empirical science and so on to do that. But I was also appealing to memoirs. And I have a very long kind of like list of things that are potentially problematic about relying memoirs as reliable epistemic sources. And that's a methodological question.
Sure.
So one would be like, well, I would always kind of, the way I tell my story may not necessarily track the truth because after all, it's my representation. Mm-hmm. And you can say, well, you know, these people are crazy. How do you trust what they say? I mean, this is kind of like a more horrible kind of way of putting
it. Some kind of objection. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, they're, you know, they're not fully rational. Like, how do you trust and so on? So, I mean, a lot of the concerns have to do with like the truth tracking and the generalizability of like these conditions, right? Or, you know, I can't say necessarily that, you know, person X, Y, Z, I mean, there's a group of people that all responded to their diagnosis in this way and so on. But nonetheless, I mean, they are kind of important concerns that we should kind of definitely keep in mind methodologically. But also the point is, I think, like, as philosophers, we have that luxury to make these conceptual claims about, look, like, these are the potential dangers and potential things that could happen. And here is like, here are different ways of illuminating it. Mm-hmm. And of course, like, we shouldn't just rely on first person, you know, testimonies of like, people with mental illness. But if we want to have a kind of comprehensive understanding of what mental illness is and how its diagnosis is affecting people, in addition to using different scientific methods, we should also use methods like reading memoirs and talking to people and so on. So it's not, if I was kind of pushing for this, like, this perspective is the best perspective
way,
and it will be dogmatic, but I'm just saying, well, this just enriches our understanding of mental illness. So and again, like, I think as a philosopher, I could say those things and, you know, that might kind of open some, you know, like, illuminate certain things that are not really typically thought of. So, yeah, that was the methodology.
I will have to go. I'm very interested. I kind of want to go. I mean, did you publish the memoirs or have include them?
I actually, like, most of my articles kind of engage with some of these memoirs. So I have a couple of pieces on grief and the kind of bereavement exclusion criteria was removed from the DSM-5.
Yep.
I have a couple of papers on that, on hypernarrating grief. One of them is with a co-author, Melissa Mosco, that was published in Journal of Public Affairs Quarterly. The other one is a book chapter. And I also have a couple of articles in philosophical psychology and philosophy, psychiatry, and psychology published where I kind of exemplify some of my concerns by, you know, a close reading of these memoirs. So, and that's how I so far use, like, memoirs in my work to kind of support some of the claims I'm making to eliminate them. But I'm actually currently working on my book where there is a kind of chapter about, like, methodology and so on, where kind of I will try to say more things about how to do this and how one, you know, a psychiatrist must pay attention to this. So, yeah.
Great. And I'd like to get to this book at this point. Is this which book is this?
Oh, so it's not published yet. I'm currently working on it.
Okay. Okay.
yeah. Reclaiming the self in psychiatry.
Oh, great.
Narratives, persons, and the science narratives and persons, basically. So that's what I'm excited right now. I'm kind of working hard to finish it in the next, hopefully, couple of years. But yeah, so that's
on the path.
Hopefully,
okay.
You can read 2 years.
Absolutely, I'll be there. Yeah. All right. So before we get to that, actually, so it sounds like you're finishing up. You know, was it at this point then? I mean, you're working in this realm of philosophy of psychiatry, and for those, there's probably a lot of listeners. Actually, we've been talking about these relations with mental illness, but they might not be familiar that there is this sub-discipline in philosophy of science that is philosophy of psychiatry. So, could you maybe say a little bit about what is it, you know, how it works, and what kinds of questions people are interested in, if you wouldn't mind.
Exactly. Sure. So absolutely. I mean, so like philosophy of psychiatry is a subdiscipline, I think, that you can kind of look at as a philosopher of mind, as a philosopher of science, or even a metaphysician or an ethicist or bioethicist. So it has, like, you know, it deals with questions around mental illness that directly relate to the kinds of philosophical questions we ask in mind, philosophy of mind, science, and like ethics and bioethics. So basically, you know, you can kind of do more, kind of conceptual work about, like, what is mental illness, how do we define it, and, you know, is it a natural kind or not? So these are kind of more philosophy of science topics, or, you know, can we use modeling in philosophy of psychiatry in kind of in terms of understanding and representing mental disorders, and how is it similar to or different from, you know, physics and chemistry and so on. So like what kind of science is basically psychiatric science. So that's kind of more the, you know, if you want to go in the philosophy of science direction, or as a kind of topic in mind, you can engage with like, well, what is the mind? You know, what do we mean actually when we talk about mental illness and the whole, you know, dualism and the mind-body problem, everything about that debate basically relates to the conceptualizations of mental illness. And also you can talk and focus on topics like the self and so on. What does it mean, you know, or agency? And that nicely brings to us to like ethics. You can talk about like agency, free will, responsibility, and mental illness. And that historically in those debates, you know, people with mental illness were ruled out, like they were not even part of the conversation about, you know, debates on, you know, agency and rationality and free will, like, you know,
Kant. Was it just, we were just going to say, yeah. how was it referred to? It was just, there was some kind of term to describe the kinds of people that Kant was referring to. I forget what it is, but it's exclusionary to those who might have or experience mental illness. No.
Yeah, exactly. Not fit the kind of the rationale, like, you know, rational, like individual kind of category. But I mean, there's now more like really exciting work being done that relates to like free will and responsibility debates to like, you know, in the psychiatric context, like, you know, Neil Levy, Christian Pering, you know, they're all working on these topics. And if you are kind of, you know, more inclined with like, you know, more biomedical or, you know, bioethics themes, you can kind of look at the psychiatric practice as a clinical and medical practice and look at, you know, various kind of conversations that come out of that, like, you know, the main four principles of bioethics, you know, autonomy, agency. So how do you respect the autonomy of the patient who has mental illness? You know, and like right now, in 2 weeks in my medical ethics class, we will be looking at whether or not patients with mental illness should be given assisted dying. And that's like a great question, because the person has to be autonomous to make those decisions. And how do we make decisions about the autonomy of a like patient in the, you know, if they are mentally ill? So there are lots of like, you know, rich questions that could kind of go in different ways. And I'm really excited that, you know, in the last, I mean, even since when I started my grad school or PhD, there's no, like, so many more books and so many more people who are working in philosophy of psychiatry. I remember when that first Oxford book series book was published in philosophy of psychiatry, that Nature and Narrative. I was almost in tears when I saw that book published, because I'm like, oh my God, philosophy of psychiatry is a thing. There's a book series about it. And I was working on my dissertation then. So that was like very exciting. So I think this is a really good and exciting time, like, because there's definitely a lot more interest in, you know, coming from all different circles. I'm really happy that, you know, philosophers of science have been very, very supportive of my work in philosophy of psychiatry.
Fantastic. So, yeah. I mean, so yes. So it sounds like things were coalescing once you were finishing and working on your dissertation, that it was found that this would be a particular discipline with which to specialize in, or at least a subspecialty, maybe philosopher of science first, or philosopher of medicine, or, you know, et cetera. Okay. And so it sounds like, it looks to me that you had a very great opportunity to do a postdoc after your PhD.
Exactly, I did. So, I mean, that was such a bad year, because the job market of tanked in 2008, and I was on the job market in 2009.
Oh, geez. I should ask, how was that being on the job market? Because, so it's often the case, we have a lot of mid-career scholars or, you know, later career scholars that were like, oh, well, you know, I was on the market in, you know, the 70s, 80s, even the 90s, and it wasn't nearly as bad. So what was it like in 2009?
That was, it was tough. And so basically in 2009, I was still writing my dissertation, and my committee said that, yeah, well, it might be a good idea for you to go on the market anyways, because, you know, just so that you kind of gain experience, right? You know, like how to put together a job material and like kind of apply and so on. But, you know, nobody was really as optimistic. I mean, myself included, to actually get a job right away. But I was also kind of naive and I didn't really know how things worked and so on. And we had placement officers in the department, Alice McLaughlin and Chris Sanders, and they were really helpful in kind of putting together my like application. It was also a very good exercise for me to kind of like to be forced to write a research statement. Yes, exactly. Where am I seeing my research in the next 5 years and stuff? I enjoy those kinds of projects. Like, it's maybe really nerdy. I'm like, yes, I get to think about my research. So that was the kind of, you know, but I really had, like, I applied, like, I don't even know how, like, I think I applied for, again, this was the time where you mail the applications, like, literally with a post, you know, like you didn't like upload or kind of send emails. Okay. Like there were actual binders that you mail to departments, and there were the APA interviews, like with the smoker and like the whole thing. So, and whoa. I guess like as I was kind of on the job market, I witnessed that transition from the smoker APA interviews to more Skype interviews. Mm-hmm. I didn't get any interviews. So like I applied for a bunch of jobs. I didn't get interviews. And that year was the last year of my PhD, and we had funding for 6 years, and I was really worried about not having anything secured next year. Like I didn't know what I would do. Like, do I go back to Turkey? Do I stay in like Canada? And like, sure. So it was kind of like very like super stressful. So I had also applied for a postdoctoral fellowship at Dalhousie University, and it was a kind of a university-wide competition, like between different departments. And I was very excited about, you know, the prospect of like potentially working with Frances Bayliss. She's a very well-known bioethicist, feminist bioethicist, and you know, she did work on narratives and the self and so on. So I was very excited to work with her. But I didn't get that university-wide kind of competition. But then she like had a huge grant from the Canadian Institute of Health Research, CIHR, for her like research institute. And she asked me, well, I could offer you from my grant a 2-year postdoctoral fellowship. Because I'm really excited to work with you, and like this project is super exciting. And that was fantastic. I mean, as you can imagine, I was so happy. I'm like, 2 years of just research, and I can learn so much. And it was a neuroethics grant, so there were a number of other philosophers who were working in various fields in neuroethics, and I was going to be working with feminist bioethicists. So in a way, I mean, for my project and for my thinking about my project too, it was very helpful, because my dissertation was more philosophy of mind, but now I was going to kind of get kind of exposed to or get to do stuff in like feminist bioethics and neuroethics. So that's how I got my first postdoctoral fellowship.
Yeah, it says it has novel tech ethics. So I imagine that encompasses emerging technologies, and then how it writes.
Exactly. Various fields in medicine, basically. And also like some, you know, animal ethics and animal cognition as well. So
okay.
It was a really, like, I had a very good group of fellow postdocs that I learned a lot, and I produced a lot in those 2 years, because I didn't have to teach, and I desperately wanted to get a permanent tenure-track job. So I was like, okay, this is my chance. I'm just going to, you know, write and try to publish and so on. So it was a good, productive, and stressful, but good 2 years. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I see you had, so in the time, there was, you know, several papers with which you wrote in ethics. Had you written any particularly just plain medical ethics or bioethics papers before?
I had not, and that was kind of good, because I was learning how to do that.
Yeah.
And then ended up, like, writing actually some encyclopedia. I mean, it was very good, because I kind of was forced to situate philosophy of psychiatry in the context of medical ethics or in ethics in general. So that was a very helpful exercise. And I wrote a couple of actually encyclopedia entries about it, which I think it was good for me to write them, because I was forced to like, okay, so I'm going to now combine all of these things in philosophy of medicine and, you know, medical ethics and all of the stuff going on in psychiatry. So that was exciting. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Encyclopedia of Bioethics and Encyclopedia of Clinical Psychology. Wow.
Yes.
All right. So it sounds like this was a fabulous opportunity. And what happened next?
Sorry, I'm interviewing. sorry.
No worries. No worries. I know we're going long. We won't go too much longer. Yeah.
That's just, okay.
Yeah, 10, 15 minutes more or so. We're almost done. So.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. So, and again, like while I was doing my postdoc in Dell, I was applying for jobs, and this time I got interviews. So I kind of made it to the next stage of like in the kind of job prospects, but it was still tight. It was still hard. And, yeah. And I think like being in Canada, I mean, I actually don't know. I don't have any rational explanations for what goes down in the job market and when the job market is really, really tight. But I was also kind of getting to like, you know, applying for other like, you know, postdoctoral fellowships at the same time and kind of making, you know, wanting to make sure that I have like some funding support for every year that I'm spending on the job market. And then I got a postdoctoral fellowship at University of Pittsburgh. That was like, that's been, I was super, super excited because the history of the center is actually kind of close to like dear to my heart too. So Adolf Grunbaum, who established the Center for Philosophy of Science, was also a big critic of Freud. And his work was some of the work that I read when I was doing my PhD. So suddenly it was like, oh my God, everything's coming to full circle. And I will be working with these philosophers of science. So it was very exciting.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So, yeah, I have a, you know, personal interest. I might maybe visiting there in a little bit. You know, what was your experience like there at Pittsburgh?
It was great. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed my time there. And it's one of those experiences where I was there for just a year. You know, it was a 1 year opportunity, but the kinds of connections and the work that I've done there had been kind of paying back. Like I'm still an associate fellow at the center. I still go to their events and give talks there and like kind of present my, you know, and like hear talks. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic place to be. I mean, there are so many different kinds of people who do work in different areas of science. But one common and fantastic thing I think about the Center for Philosophy of Science is that philosophers of science take the science that they are doing the philosophy of very seriously. So, and that was very helpful for me, like to see, observe, and like methodologically get ideas as well. I'm like, okay, so here is how the philosopher of paper, physics or chemistry is constructing an argument. And okay, this is like helpful. So you learn so much, like things about other subjects, but also you learn so much about how to write, how to present, how to think about like these complex issues as a philosopher of science. So that was fantastic. And it was it's a very rich environment. We had one or two talks every week. Once a month, there would be annual lecture series. And the fellow group that we had, there's a senior fellow at the time. It was Kyle Stanford who was there. And he was a fantastic mentor, leader, and so on in that group. So it was just really people read what you wrote carefully and gave you different feedback. Like, you know, suddenly you're getting feedback from a philosopher of physics for your work in philosophy of psychiatry. So it was just, like, really interesting. So I highly, you know, I think it made a huge impact on my thinking and career and my like work afterwards. So, I mean, I was very lucky. Both of my postdoctoral fellowships gave me fantastic kind of enrichments in different areas in different ways. So it was really good.
So, you know, what can you say in terms of how philosophers of science, or for example, you mentioned you interacted with philosophers of physics, philosophers of chemistry. How can they learn from one another when they're working in very, you know, disparate areas in different sciences?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the challenges or maybe strengths or kind of exciting things about doing philosophy of science is like this kind of conceptual work. So the way in which that, I don't know, like physicists or psychiatrists use a concept doesn't necessarily mean like, or doesn't necessarily mean the same thing when that concept is used in like philosophy. And that was very helpful. Like you kind of, you know, even, you know, when you're reading a philosophy of chemistry paper or biology paper where you have like really not a lot of idea about what's going on, you can still kind of ask these more kind of structural or conceptual questions about, okay, so you use this concept this way here. Is that really what the scientists are talking about? Like, I'm confused. So that was, you know, that was one of the main things. I'm like, oh, actually, so this is a constraint and a problem, but also it can be like where philosophers can play a good role. Like if I ask two neuroscientists working in different labs on like using similar concepts, what if I say, well, actually, you guys don't mean the same thing. So how is that going to affect? And I think, again, like as philosophers, we have that opportunity of kind of like reading carefully and like tracking that. So I guess that's kind of always look for kind of concepts and like background assumptions in the sciences that are working, because they are really good, rich potentials for philosophical work.
Fantastic. Yeah. I think that's a really good lesson to be learned and a way of to go forward. And so I also know, I wasn't there for it, but I heard that you had coordinated or helped coordinate a philosophy of psychiatry early career workshop.
Yes, that was exciting. Yeah. So at the time, so when I was a postdoc there, like I kind of learned off the opportunity that like people kind of can apply to get some funding from the center and from the university as a whole to organize conferences in different themes. Mm-hmm. And John Norton was the director at the time. And he encouraged me to, oh, maybe you can think of something to do in philosophy of psychiatry. And I said, because I was talking to him a lot about professional issues. I'm like, nobody knows what philosophy of psychiatry is. Like, why is it not popular? And I feel like all these junior scholars are not getting the support that they could need. I mean, they need, like, the field is not growing because there's no explicit kind of recognition that there's
There's not a specialty. It's not a ranked thing. Yeah.
Exactly. It's not a, like, you know, thing. So, and then he was like, well, why don't you, like, you know, do something that kind of has, like, this, you know, like, agenda where you kind of mentor or, you know, pull out junior scholars and present their work and so on. And Edward Machery was really, really supportive of that idea. So, Katie Tapp, mm-hmm. who was a graduate student at the time, and now she's at Columbia, she and I kind of brainstormed. Kent Schaffner was involved. He was very supportive, and Peter McAmer as well. So we applied, we wrote this proposal and kind of applied for it, and we got the grant from the center. So we organized this early career philosophy of psychiatry conference, which was fantastic. We organized it in a way that junior philosophers present their work and senior philosophers comment on that work. Mm. Actually, there are now two special issues coming that feature some of the papers that were presented there. One special issue is Philosophy, Psychiatry, and Psychology Journal. It should be out next year. And the other one is in Synthes. We have a Philosophy of Psychiatry kind of special issue coming out. Yeah, so it's very exciting. And, like, I mean, a lot of great kind of work came out of that. Also, like, I think it forged some mentorship connections and so on between the junior philosophers of psychiatry and the more senior philosophers of psychiatry. So that was great. I'm really glad that we did it. And I think it was just fantastic that it was kind of hosted by the Center for Philosophy of Science, which is very well recognized for philosophy of science. So yeah. It's kind of this official endorsement from cool philosophers of science that philosophy of psychiatry is a legitimate discipline that, you know, should be respected, promoted, and so on. So,
I'm thrilled as someone who's in the discipline or is interested in the discipline myself. Happy to see it have a more official title. And you also have, I mean, I'm looking at the grant here, and you have these, you know, these top philosophers of science connected to it as well, with Bill Bechtel, Peter Machaber, Edward Machery, Ken Schaffner, folks who were never, maybe not philosophers of psychiatry first, but still nevertheless have done important work in the field. So,
exactly. So, it was great. I'm really glad that they supported us.
Okay, so after your year at Pittsburgh, and we're almost getting to the present time, what became next?
So then I was also on the job market, and I got a few kind of opportunities, few offers. And in fact, I had an offer from a really good university in Turkey as well, which is research oriented university, Boğaziçi University. And it was kind of tough. Like, do I stay? Do I go back? You know, because I always kind of had in mind that I would go back, but I was also very much into philosophy and what I was doing that I wanted to, like, make sure that I'm kind of still present, you know, publishing, etc., and, like, kind of in the kind of heart of things. Mm-hmm. And things in Turkey weren't kind of necessarily on a kind of positive direction at the time. I was worried about being an academic there. Mm-hmm. So, and I, And like I also got an offer from Damon College in Buffalo, and it was a primarily health college. They have lots of health and professional programs, and liberal arts is very, very important too. So I thought, well, this could be a great place, because and I was kind of developing interest in medical humanities and kind of how can humanities illuminate some of the issues of research and treatment in medicine. So I'm like, this looks like a great place for me, because I can do like I can continue to do what I'm doing now, like in terms of research, but also, you know, because there are so many health related departments, maybe like some new things will come out of it. So, sure. And it was, you know, ideal location. I'm close to Pittsburgh. I'm close to Toronto. So I, you know, I'm like, yeah, two of my favorite places. I'm close to both of them. So that's, you know, I've been here for 5 years now. This is my fifth year. So
fantastic.
That's how I ended up. Yes.
So it sounds like a great location. And yeah, how has it been teaching, doing research at Damon?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, I mean, it's been, I had been very productive. It's been really kind of good for 5 years for me. I have a fairly heavy teaching load, mm-hmm. and kind of that balancing the teaching and research is always a struggle.
Yeah.
I have like a 4-3. Like a 4-3 load, but you know, after a while, I mean, I love teaching, and I really love working with students and like mentoring and so on. So I was kind of lucky to have a few good students who, kind of I helped in their research, and they were interested in mental disorder and psychiatry and so on. So I kind of helped one of them publish a few things, and now she's in law school. So because it's a small place, you can kind of have this like direct impact on students, and that was very helpful for me too, because I could see where my teaching and research can come together as well. So it was a kind of good learning experience for me too. And because I had 3 full years of research experience prior to my tenure track job, there were lots of projects that I had already started, and I just kind of continued with them. And I think that's the secret, like if you are kind of juggling so many things at the same time, just kind of keep doing it, because it's like, you know, once you have the momentum, because, you know, time is a struggle, like that's definitely a struggle, but
yeah.
You can still kind of try to make the best of your circumstances and so on. And if you can find like links, overlaps between your research and teaching, which is definitely the case for me, it's just made things a lot more doable and manageable. So.
Okay. And have you found, I mean, so we started, you know, you had talked about in your undergrad having the opportunity to teach and being very excited about that enlightenment lecture you had first given. Yeah. I'm sure teaching changes over time, but I mean, you know, how do you relate to teaching now? It sounds like, you know, research is like kind of the number one passion, but like how does it, I don't know, how does your teaching fit in?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that I kind of discovered is like, so my first semester of teaching medical ethics was like kind of rough, because I was, like, I guess I was trying to teach it in a way what I thought medical ethics should be taught. Like, it was kind of like, I wanted to really master like teaching it, like a particular way of teaching medical ethics. So it was kind of like, I'm not feeling this. Like, there's like something that's kind of like cumbersome and like, not, and I decided to like, kind of treat myself as a student. I'm like, okay, what do I want to learn? And what do I want to kind of, or how do I want to set things up? And I'm like, okay, I really like actual medical cases, actual like stories or things that happen to people. And then I kind of personalized teaching in a way that like was a lot more authentic to like what I liked and what I felt like, and also what I thought students like should definitely know. Like, for instance, I focus a lot on gender and race in my medical ethics class, because I think those are very pressing and important issues in contemporary society and contemporary medicine. And I've started doing a lot of research in those areas and kind of presenting the students best. And as you know, as time goes, I was actually just thinking about that yesterday after my class. I'm like, I'm a lot more confident now in front of a class that, and you know, you have this like big kind of background, and like things come a lot more easily. So you worry less about, you know, I'm, you know, very goofy and funny in classes, and kind of try to like, and you know, kind of being in touch with your student version of yourself is also a good idea, because I'm like, I remember as an undergrad, like I did these kinds of things, and these were intimidating, and you kind of like communicate. So yeah, I guess that's, Yeah, and like I guess like I felt like I became a better teacher when I stopped kind of acting in like, you know, bad faith in Sartrean terms, like, you know, like Sartre discusses like the waiter is trying to clean the table. He is trying to make himself an object or a waiter, but like it's like very tense. He's not being authentic, I guess.
Not being, kind of yeah, this, yeah. You're being or acting as if how you should be or something like that, or
exactly. And I kind of, when I stop doing that, I'm just like acting more authentically. Like, and I bring a lot of things that I'm struggling with or I'm thinking about in my like work as well to classroom, and that's always helpful.
Sorry, yeah. My wife just walked in. Sorry, my apologies.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, that's really great to hear. Yeah, I found that. Yeah, certainly, I can relate with a lot of the teaching moments in terms of, yeah, the you know, the being a little bit intimidated, certainly, and getting in touch with, yeah, coming into, I guess, yeah, finding your, I don't know, for lack of better terms, true self or something in terms of, and your student's version of yourself is good. I like that.
Exactly.
Cool. So well, let's catch us up. Let's before I ask some, you know, questions about philosophy of science in general, what's going on with you now in terms of, you know, current work you might be excited about? I know you had mentioned a book. What kinds of work are you into?
So actually, like, one thing that we are kind of almost completing now. So I just recently had a co-edited book came out with the MIT Press with Jeff Poland, and that's on crisis in psychiatric research. And that's a like collection of really good essays from various philosophers of science about the, you know, philosophy of science related topics and like philosophy of psychiatry, and especially the most recent DSM-5 and the National Institute of Mental Health.
Is this the extraordinary psychiatry? Is this the extraordinary psychiatry?
Yes, extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
science.
Exactly. Yes, and we had like that kind of Kuhnian lens, and you know, kind of try to like make sense of what's going on in psychiatric research now, like in terms of Kuhn. Is this a crisis? Mm-hmm. Is there a paradigm shift happening, or is it still like, are we still in normal science and so on? So it was a very exciting and kind of fun book to work with Jeff. Mm-hmm. And now I'm working on my own monograph and manuscript. So, and that's very exciting. Mm-hmm. And that sort of draws on some of the themes that I developed in my dissertation, but it like has a lot more philosophy of science themes, and it kind of aims to develop an account of the self that will enrich psychiatric science and psychiatric knowledge. So that's what's really like exciting these days. I just finished my book, you know, proposal, and I'm kind of trying to find a press who was excited to publish that, and just kind of plugging away and writing the chapters and so on. So that's very exciting. And also a colleague and I are working on a textbook, which you might be interested in, for undergraduates. It's an undergraduate textbook in philosophy of psychiatry that connects philosophy of psychiatry to main subdisciplines in philosophy.
Oh, that's great.
It's a collected book. Like, we have different, mostly mid-career and early-career people writing for us, and it's also like more established philosophers. It's supposed to be an undergraduate textbook that, you know, someone can pick up and, you know, teach students introductory level philosophy of psychiatry. So those are a few projects that I'm working on.
Very exciting. I'm so happy about, before I get to the monograph, you had the textbook. I had happened to teach a philosophy of psychiatry class a couple years ago. I ended up using there's like a 2006 textbook that came out. You probably are familiar with it. The Oxford book, and it was good, but it was designed for a master's program, and it was, I don't know, yeah. I'm excited for a new book, basically.
That's what we aim, kind of like keep the language very accessible and simple and not assume a lot of like philosophy or psychiatry background. So it's kind of like in have a like list of people, like further work that you could assign to your students and so on. So I'm really like, and I had the same experience. I tried to teach philosophy of psychiatry a few times to undergraduates, and like based on my experience, I'm like, okay, this is the kind of book we might need or might be more helpful teaching. So
So I'm really curious about this. Well, maybe we'll have to wait until the book comes out, but this sense of self that you enriched, this seems, I'm not sure if this is almost like a response or a positive program that, from your dissertation work that discussed, seemed like the DSM and its impact on its negative impact on a sense of self for psychiatric science, psychiatric knowledge. And so it seems like, is this project one that starts by developing a more, you know, robust philosophical account of the self separate from psychiatry, and then you plug it into psychiatry, or, you know, what's your method?
That's a good question. So basically the first kind of the idea is like to kind of, so I'm basically defending that the concept of self is a useful concept for psychiatry to use to expand understanding of like mental illness. So it's a kind of epistemological project. So, and then I kind of look at, okay, so what is the self, right? That's like the big, like, you know, question that kept like philosophers of mind very busy, or, you know, even, you know, phenomenologists or psychoanalysts or psychiatrists, like it's such a kind of rich, or psychologists too, like the, you know, how people define the self varies in like with respect to their like profession and their subdiscipline. And as you know, like in philosophy, an anti-realist view of self is very popular, that there's no such thing as the self, and there's like it's kind of the center of all of these metaphysical questions about like whether the self, there is such thing as a self, and so on. So and I kind of like, you know, that like is it's very messy. So and I don't want to spend so much time in like kind of more metaphysical account of the self, but I kind of do go over, you know, like, so I'm a realist about the self. In fact, I just wrote a piece for Aeon magazine that will be coming out, where I kind of bravely come out and say, hey, I'm a realist about the self, and here's but so I'm basically kind of going over, like, you know, this idea of like the self, and, you know, why has the concept of self has not been used as a target of scientific inquiry in psychiatry. So it was never kind of studied as a target, as an empirical subject, as a matter in its own right. And I kind of look at some of these presuppositions about the self that prevented this kind of research program perhaps being discovered or being developed. And for that, I kind of look at, like, you know, the common kind of suspicions or skepticisms about the notion of the self, which we see both in, you know, philosophy, and also to a certain extent, like psychiatry. Like, you know, there's this heavy association of the concept of the self with psychoanalysis or phenomenology, and, you know, scientific psychiatry wanted to kind of move away from those kinds of fuzzy or not super clear concepts that remind them, like, you know, of like psychoanalysis and so on, and attempts to be more scientific. They also kind of left behind the important tools or the important kind of insights that could come out of the concept of the self. So kind of the first, you know, third of the book kind of deals with, okay, why is like self, why has self never been an explicit target of inquiry in psychiatric science? And then I kind of go over these assumptions and kind of debunk those assumptions, and then develop a positive account of the self, with the kind of project of using it for psychiatry. So it's not a metaphysics book in the sense that I'm not like developing a, like, you know, theory of the self that is true and like ideal for every purpose, but it's a very pragmatic goal. I'm like, okay, so our goal inside psychiatry is this, you know, we want to help improve people's life. And if we want, if that's our final goal, given that that's our final goal, how can we conceptualize mental illness in relation to the self? So I kind of develop a model of the self. So that's kind of the summary of the book.
Fantastic. Oh, this sounds very exciting. I'm very much looking forward to it. I guess it'll be in a couple years. I imagine it takes a while to write such a such an extensive work.
And, like, you know, most of the parts are kind of written, and I develop some of these ideas and defended views in like different places. So it's just a matter of now kind of sitting down and finding the time, just plugging it away. So,
well, maybe we can get a bit in the Aeon piece, probably.
Or yes, exactly. You will get a snapshot. And also, I just published a paper in Synthes. I think that the online publication just came out. It's like The Missing Self in Scientific Psychiatry. So that's also a kind of a, you know, might give you an idea about where I'm going with some of the arguments that I develop in the book. So
fantastic. Okay. Well, okay. So last but not least, and then I'll let you go. I'm curious about maybe some just general thoughts in terms of philosophy of science. What are some of the you know, major challenges that you see in the field. Or if you'd like to speak more specifically to philosophy of psychiatry, that's fine too. But I'm curious of you work as a working philosopher of science. Yeah, what are some of the challenges or goals that you foresee for philosophy of science?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a good question. I always cared about philosophy and science, actually, obviously, making a difference in the world we live in. And I think in contemporary world, and I think this is kind of a universal phenomenon at this point, there's a lot of like anti-science or pseudoscience or kind of, you know, sentiments against science that's going on. Like, science used to be a very respected, I know, field. Like, we always, oh yeah, objectivity, truth, facts. Like, we were all, and these were kind of novel things that we should strive at. But now I'm worried a little bit about kind of the public reception of science, I should say, and how science is being kind of regarded. And I think as philosophers, we have a lot more. I mean, I will give you specific examples. Just a couple of months ago in Turkey, evolution was removed from the curriculum in schools. So I was, you know, very alarmed by that. I'm like, oh, wow. So
what
my
was
nephew,
the justification for that?
It's a theory. It's not truth. I mean,
okay.
That was,
yeah, I don't even know why I asked. I guess it's just I'm just curious.
It's not proven, but of course, I mean, it's not the like. I mean, that's like the whole like. It shows you how like, you know, kind of the conceptualized, how there's a poor understanding of how the science works. But I think, you know, it's because it's against, you know, more kind of religious ways of seeing the world. So on. So various things, similar things are happening in kind of different parts of the U.S. as well. So I really, or, you know, like, I'm worried about like the anti-vaccination movement. Like, I'm really worried that some people think that vaccination causes autism. Like, it's not true. Like, there's no such thing. So, and I think philosophers, I mean, you know, I think philosophers of science, we have that responsibility of like educating the public and kind of engaging with the public and making sure that, like, you know, science is represented properly, and also kind of keep also scientists accountable for, yeah, good, do good work. And, you know, we must kind of make sure that science doesn't lose its kind of strength and its power and so on. So that's kind of, you know, the general philosophy of science, I guess we kind of, perhaps as a discipline, we should be more interested in engaging with the public about science. And philosophy of psychiatry, I think more work needs to be done to kind of show the continuity between the main areas in philosophy and philosophy of psychiatry, because it's still kind of perceived as a marginal field, even though a lot of the questions that philosophers of psychiatry are trying to answer are continuous with the general philosophical questions. And I'm, you know, that was the kind of intention to write this undergraduate textbook for me, because I really wanted to kind of show that, oh, there's this continuum. It's actually, you know, very philosophical to think about mental illness and so on. So I think that kind of work could be done more in philosophy of psychiatry. And similarly, also more kind of education of like patients and people with mental illness, kind of to be aware of the kind of intrinsic controversies and dilemmas and questions in psychiatric science. I think that will have that has a very important role in directly in the lives of the patients or their families and so on. So I guess to summarize, like, more public engagement and more kind of dispositions of continuity between philosophy of psychiatry and other fields of philosophy.